you can begin relatively small,
mm-hmm.
right? Even thinking about adequate sidewalks to walk on starts you down a path to a more livable community.
Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere on the internet, WFPR.FM, and in the local Franklin Mass FM radio dial 102.9. Here in studio today, another glorious day outside. We're inside with my climate guide, Ted McIntyre. Ted, happy Tuesday. How are you doing today?
I'm doing just great, Steve. Good to be here. And you're right, it's beautiful outdoors, but the canary yellow walls in this studio make me happy.
Make
so,
you happy?
Happy to be here.
Yes, yes. It's a nice sound environment, soundproof environment. The audio quality of what we're saying should be really good. The quality of what we're actually saying hopefully is good.
We're going to work on that part.
Yeah. And dear listener, yes, give us some feedback. Say, Steve, what are you doing? Or go this way, go that way. But in terms of starting today, we saw some headlines around the Biden administration initiating some tariffs on electronic vehicles.
Yes, this touches on, there's a lot to unpack around what we're looking at here. The Biden administration, specifically what happened was the Biden administration has imposed tariffs on certain commodities. Right. Big word.
Mm-hmm.
Certain commodities, mostly things that come from China. So let's back up and just to make sure, a tariff, what we're talking about, a tariff is essentially a tax that's imposed at the border when you bring something into the country. Right? Used to be before the IRS was invented, tariffs and customs were the way you paid for the U.S. government, right?
Sure.
What
customs.
Was brought into the, into the country. So a tariff, and you should keep in mind the other historical fact that I think it's here's a pop history quiz. The Smoot-Hawley tariff.
Oh, I remember that from high school days,
So that was in the early 1930s, a round of international tit-for-tat tariffs between nations that essentially froze up international commerce in the 1930s and led to, surprise, the Great Depression. Anyway, put all that aside. That's all preamble to what Biden has imposed a tariff on certain things that are relevant to climate. Right? So he's put a tariff on electric vehicles from China. He's put a tariff on certain semiconductor chips from China, on photovoltaics from China, and on battery materials from China, right? Why would you impose a tax at the border on goods from China? Well, again, huge backstory. But the idea here, typically the idea of the tariffs is to protect your national industries. That is to say, despite, let's take semiconductors. There was a time when semiconductors, by definition, were built in the United States.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
But then they all started to find, companies would find cheaper production costs by going to first Japan, then Korea, then Taiwan, then Singapore, and now most of it's in China, which is the big place. The Biden administration, under something called the CHIPS Act, appropriately named, I forget what the CHIPS
stands
for.
There's an acronym that comes out for CHIPS, right.
But it's an effort to make semiconductors again in the U.S. And the genesis of that is when the pandemic hit, there were no chips to manufacture cars built in the United States. They all came from China. And so, boom, the automobile industry crashed. So the administration sees that the chip stuff, the semiconductor manufacturer, is important for national security and in an election year for jobs.
Sure.
That's why what they're doing is putting a tax on chips, computer chips that come in from China, in order to give some breathing room for the American chips to be sold at a competitive price, especially because the Chinese government is potentially, the government is dumping money into the chip manufacturers so they can make the chips really cheap. And when they come over here, they're cheaper than what can be made by the private industry in the United States.
So,
anyway,
It's an attempt to kind of balance the field in terms of, oh, U.S. company trying to source product. Now you may have a chance to take a U.S. product as opposed to getting a cheaper product from China.
And, of course, we haven't even gotten to the green part of this yet, but there's all kinds of pushback and round and round. Because who pays the tariff? Despite what some political leaders think, that they can just put a tariff on and China pays the tariff, nay, 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 the U.S. consumer pays that tariff if they want to buy some. And they pay it either way, because they're going to pay it to the American company that costs more, or they're going to pay it to the government to get the Chinese product, blah, blah, blah. So there's lots of problems with tariffs. They're not some magic solution.
No.
They have this imaginary way they work, but it's not necessarily that way. Anyway, the other thing, in addition to the chips that the Biden administration has done, they've imposed a tariff on electric vehicles from China. Now, why would they do that? There's not many Chinese electric vehicles being sold in the United States right now, right? But you've certainly heard that the administration is pushing a renaissance in the American automobile industry.
Mm-hmm.
And what they want is the jobs for making electric vehicles to be based here in the United States.
Sure.
And therefore, by preventing the Chinese, who are supported by the Chinese government with big bucks, to flood the market with cheaper electric vehicles, that's... And the catchphrase I heard, and this is kind of snide, but I mean, it's the electric vehicle efforts of the United States government are not trying to save the planet. They are trying to save the automobile industry, right? So because you could say, in a perfect world, if China's making them cheap, bring them in. We'll all drive those electric vehicles. It's
right.
Better for everybody.
Yeah.
So there's politics involved here. The other thing that the... they've imposed a new tariff on the Biden administration is on solar cells. Now, this leads into a big discussion that solar cells are becoming extremely cheap, and the power generation from solar cells is starting to change mm-hmm. the grid in the United States.
Right? Sure.
But flooding the market with PVs from China hurts American jobs of manufacturing.
Right.
And of course, again, I don't know if you remember back to Evergreen Solar, right
mm-hmm.
here in Massachusetts, that got bought by China, and you know, and so
right.
all the technology
right.
went. Now they're trying to bring some of that stuff back here. Our the prior administration had also put a tariff on the same thing, and you can wonder, you know, why is the new administration doing anything the last administration did? Again, is to protect the internal industry, but a reasonable person can wonder, can kind of blink and say, gee, if I can get a cheap PV, isn't that better mm-hmm. all the way around?
Right.
And finally, Steve, I know the final thing that they're talking about putting a tariff on, which again is a way to limit the entry into the United States of this material from China, presumably help the Americans build the local industry where it costs more, is for the materials that go into grid-scale batteries. That is to say,
mm-hmm.
batteries, again, these are things that are impacting the grid in new ways. We can talk, I'd love to talk about it, but the battery stuff, and that leads into questions of, you know, how many, does the United States want to be mining its own lithium, raping the West to get lithium,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
Strategic national security issue that if China owns all of the supply chain for these rare materials,
yeah.
are we in trouble?
That's a risk.
So there's all kinds of stuff involved
yeah.
here. I mean, it's a mixed bag, but that's what they've done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in a sense, it's the Biden administration is saying we're spending a ton of money under the Inflation Reduction Act to get this green energy out there. Why should we send that money to China?
Mm-hmm.
Let's have those jobs here.
Right. Yeah, and it's hard to, on the one hand, follow because the simple story, it's not simple.
There's no simple story, yeah.
But yeah, the intent is let's get green. Okay, let's give some money to the U.S. companies to help the economy and workers and good paying jobs and all that kind of good stuff. you mentioned Evergreen, okay, got bought by a Chinese company. So in the purchase, they get some of the technology. Now they have the IP intellectual property rights to it. There's also many reports in terms of their subterfuge, probably some way of saying that they've, you know, taken other intellectual property that we haven't been fairly compensated for. So one way to, you know, get around that is, okay, well, instead of just banning it, just put a tariff on it. So you're not stopping it totally, but now whoever is in the marketplace for these components, well, you can get it from China and pay a higher price, or you can get it from the U.S. and theoretically pay at least the same price, lower cost, shipment, transit, et cetera. Maybe over time, even a lower cost because they'll have gotten to some efficiencies, et cetera. So all well and good to that extent. But yeah, it's not a simple story.
It's not, by no means is it a simple story. And it has a lot of ramifications. I mean, one since we're on the subject of tariffs, the other thing to throw in there is that there's something very similar to a tariff, but it goes by the name, a border carbon equalization tax or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that certain countries do not think about the carbon emissions associated with manufacturing a widget, whatever it is.
Right.
They have coal plants burning away, they're making widgets and they're sending it to the United States. Whereas the guys in the United States are trying to make the same widget, but they have more pollution controls they have to pay for.
Right.
And so there's this border equalization tax where, based on carbon, where if the United States knows a particular thing has emitted a lot of carbon in its manufacture overseas, then there's a tax on it to equalize, to pay for that carbon.
Mm-hmm.
Then that further, everything has a rebound. So then you say, okay, yeah, the United States is going to righteously tax stuff that's made in another country that isn't clean, but we're still buying the stuff, right? So there, we are sort of, in a sense, outsourcing the carbon pollution to some other country,
right.
And that's not good either. So.
No, it gets back, comes back ultimately to our other topic that we've touched on a few times in terms of the economic justice of it all. At some point in time, the wealthier countries, of which, yeah, verily we're one of them, needs to compensate and help the lesser countries because it is still a world problem. We are in it together. We're going to have to get there and somehow, and they're not going to have the wherewithal to do so. They're going to need our help.
Yeah. Tariffs, you will see, are an interesting question. I think it's mixed, right? It's a lot of politics in it, and it depends on how you feel about globalization. And then globalization, of course, meaning that, in a sense, a snide way of talking about globalization says that big corporations can go do what they want, where they want, get the cheapest labor, and then come back and give you that good. And you're supposed to be happy with it, even though you no longer have a job because the job you used to have is now gone somewhere else.
Right.
So if you like globalization, okay. If you don't like globalization, this, what Biden's done, plays into that.
Well, and if the globalization, to borrow the phrase, truly raises all the boats, that may be okay, but we suspect that some of the cases, the globalization doesn't necessarily raise the boats in some of those places. So you're furthering the injustice. You're not helping it.
It's globalization, of course, is a long, again, it, specifically globalization in this context means free markets that you can bring goods in and out of a country without any kind of tariff.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, you could, a corporation could take the manufacture of a item, and we'll call it a widget, right? And it could even pay the people in the locality more money than they were used to before, right? But that's still not comparable to what they would have had to pay a U.S. worker,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it's a very, on the other hand, then you rewind. Let's go back to the Smoot-Hawley thing,
mm-hmm.
right? In the 1930s, what happened is everybody put up protective tariffs to preserve their industries. And what happened? The world, basically the world economy, ground to a halt.
Shut down,
right?
Yeah.
And you can't, so there's some middle ground. And the middle ground has to be based on, you know, fairness and equity to all the people involved, right? Not
right.
Anyway, I won't go on my my anti-capitalism, my anti-corporate screed again. Well,
capitalism certainly has some pluses, and this may be at least one of the minuses. Yeah. To the extent that even the Adam Smith, you know, invisible hand doesn't necessarily always work.
Yeah. I mean, we live, again, in my humble opinion, we live in a sort of corporate capitalist era mm-hmm. where the corporations basically set the rules to protect themselves
right.
and everyone else. So this
even
idea,
becoming a citizen, at least legally.
So the idea you say, oh, you know, I love capitalism, free market, it ain't. And if so, just if I could
throw pontificate.
Continue to pontificate. I was, you know, there was some truck that rolled by, some 18-wheeler with, you know, it had flags painted on it, and, you know, truckers keep the world roll. Fair enough, right? Truckers do a great job. But if you're going to look at a truck and say this is a cheap way to transport stuff, you have to count the billions of dollars that have gone into building the highway system.
Sure.
If you don't take that into account, then it's incredible. And it's like trains could do the same thing if you wanted to put the money into the train tracks, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
But we don't do that. On the other hand, we close our eyes to the cost that we're all putting in the money we're putting into the highway. Say, oh, trucks are wonderful. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, from a transportation perspective, you know, canals and barges were the thing, and then they got surmised or surpassed by the rail, and then the rail in turn gets surpassed by the highways. But
that was all, I would argue, that was all a very conscious choice.
Market choice.
Well, a choice, certainly in the 50s, that the car was the future.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we all wanted to build our cities around cars,
sure.
everything around
played
cars.
To the American dream, et cetera.
Played to the American dream, and you could have preserved this train. I mean, they knocked down Penn Station in New York, right? I mean, they
mm-hmm.
And it comes back to the concept that by making small changes now towards more sustainable future, those things compound, and it gets easier to make the bigger changes later on.
Mm-hmm. Theoretically, I think that refers back to your critical path thesis, that if clearly you make a decision, then it makes it easier for the next one and so forth. But yeah, you still got to be careful of the roadblocks and other distractions along the way until you truly get kind of the tipping point where you're really kind of like on greased lightning, the skids just going.
But I mean, you got to begin somewhere. In a small town outside of Boston, you could think about more bike routes for people to actually carry on business. You could ride to work on a bike without mm-hmm. risking death and, you know, loss of limbs on the roadways every day.
Absolutely.
And those are baby steps, but
oh, yeah.
they do accumulate and they make it easier to talk about more and more mm-hmm. Bike lanes. So.
Yeah, well, before even getting to the bike lanes, I'll talk about sidewalks because, you know, if you're not going to bike, you're going to walk. And there is an inequity in amongst Franklin as it is that some roads have two sidewalks, some have only one, some have none. And then obviously there's a condition of the walk in each of those three scenarios where if there's no sidewalk there, you're walking in the gutter, it's going to be dangerous and hazardous, especially in the darkened hours, et cetera, whether on a bike or on foot. If you got the one sidewalk and nothing on the other side, if the sidewalk's not so maintained, then it may not be safe for somebody in a wheelchair. So you'll go to the road. Now you're running a risk. The road may be better paved, but you're still in the risk because you're in the traffic lane. And then you've got kind of the two sidewalk, which in some cases is in the neighborhood, not necessarily in downtown. So, you know, Franklin is not equitable, and trying to at least stop and realize, okay, how should we prioritize our dollars and where should we prioritize our dollars? You know, we've kind of got, you know, overlay districts, you know, to foster sort of another cannabis operation comes in, they come into the industrial commercial area because that's an acceptable place for them. There's no schools, there's no residentials, it's okay there. I'm conceiving that we should have kind of a sidewalk overlay that would help prioritize. Let's get the listing of the sidewalks that exist, figure out where we really should go. And maybe there it's part of the master plan, because if people are not aware, there is a master plan effort going along to update our next 10-year plan. And one part of it is transportation. There's another part of it about an open space and recreation. And sidewalks and bike paths kind of cross in both of those pots. So it may be in there. I haven't yet seen kind of the individual objectives coming out from the group yet. That should be coming fairly soon. And once those start coming out, that's when I want to get involved.
But I think for any town, or for any listener, it's the idea that you can begin relatively small, right? Even thinking about adequate sidewalks to walk on starts you down a path to a more livable community, right? And that can happen at any scale. I mean, Franklin is fairly, I guess we're semi-rural or we're exurban. But, I mean, you could think about the same things in major cities, bigger towns, smaller towns. You begin to think about how are people getting around, where are they shopping, how do they get to the shopping. Those are simplified questions that have long-term consequences.
They do.
They're good to mull on occasionally.
Yeah, because I think coming down the road, and it won't necessarily be tomorrow because there's certainly been some efforts that have been shot down in the past couple of years around trying to bring some commercial areas into what is predominantly residential. But to that extent, to the extent that we have a residential community, and clearly there's a whole bunch of single-family homes there, that's the way it was built, that was the way it's designed, single-family. But now you're forcing everybody to get into a vehicle to do whatever.
Right.
As opposed to having something somewhere in the middle somewhere, or maybe on the edge, but it's still going to be closer than the Big Y Shores or Stop and Shop to get whether it's milk and bread or to get a haircut or, you know, something light commercial retail type operation.
When I was a kid,
you had a corner store.
There was a corner store.
Yeah.
It was a block and a half away. Your mother would say, "Oh, you'll go get milk up at Chuck's," and you'd go get it and bring it back. And you not only learn how to make change, right, do some stuff, but it's an interesting concept that many neighborhoods, not just in Franklin but across the state, are not. They're bedroom communities in the sense that there is no way. There's no opportunity to walk to the services that you want, to walk to the library, walk. And the concept that I've heard, you've probably heard of as well, Steve, of a 15-minute city.
Yes.
Right, where you can get to most of the places in a 15-minute walk. That's a great ideal. I mean, it's hard to make happen, but it's a goal to think about how can you. And of course, it's climate related. So number one, it's quality of life. Number two, it's climate related because if you don't have to drive everywhere and you have, you can get to these services just by walking, that's a good thing.
Absolutely.
From a climate perspective.
Yep.
And the implications are for, you know, denser communities, more transportation options, right? Not just automobiles, right? And again, it's right now a playground that you can think about what could you do.
Right? Mm-hmm.
There's lots of options and
nothing
set in stone. But to begin with the idea that it is at least possible that your grandparents' town wasn't so crazy, right? How it was laid out then was not bad.
True.
It didn't work if you put 10,000 cars in it, but if you didn't have the 10,000 cars, you could revert to a more pleasant lifestyle, right?
Agreed. Yeah, it's all good. It kind of sets us up to, and I've done a podcast separately, but to introduce in this space, there is a group now in Franklin just launched, Building Equitable Neighborhoods for Franklin, BEN for Franklin for short. That's the website, benforfranklin.org. I've posted to Franklin Matters a recent podcast with a couple of collaborators or originators on that. We also had a launch event here at the studio last Friday. We had a James Jacobs walk on Saturday. Kobe invited me to do that last year, and I said, yeah, that sounds like fun. So we redid it this year. And the walk was to that point. We started here at the station, walked downtown, did some, you know, neighborhood streets, you know, like these are places in Franklin that we either walk by, drive by. Okay, how did they get here? Right. Clearly, most of them was built in the time before the zoning. And the key piece that keeps me involved is having gone through kind of the move that I did, and that's a separate topic. But it's hard for us to maintain an affordable house here in Franklin. And I'm at least becoming convinced that zoning is one of the ways that we have some opportunities to make those changes, right? So heaven forbid, a building down on Main Street, we like it. We go there. We shop there. Something disastrous happens to that building. The zoning is such that building, as it stands today, heaven forbid, could not be rebuilt because of the setbacks, the parking, the other requirements that are in today's zoning. That, I think, is a problem. And I understand the zoning certainly evolved over time, right? But now let's make that evolutionary step to the more sustainable future, the more financially affordable future. I think they're coming together to that extent. Mm-hmm. And that's worthy of discussion. The group, it doesn't have, it's got a mission to help educate ourselves, right? What's your vision of a future? You've grown up in a neighborhood. You had a neighborhood store. Okay, so did I. I grew up in a three tenement. There's very few of them here. Currently zoned, you can't really do that. Why? Why is a three tenement not allowed by right? Right. How can we change that? Can we change that? Do you have to fight City Hall in order to do so? No, you don't have to fight City Hall. You've got to build those conversations. So by having those conversations, and we had almost, I think it was 20, 25 people on the Jane's Walk. We had some great conversations. Hopefully those conversations will further other conversations. We'll start to coalesce around, oh, let's try and do this. Oh, let's try and do this. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, get more people involved in the conversation. And, you know, two heads better than one, four heads better than two, that it exponentially will get somewhere.
I think that the question of zoning, I don't really know that much about it, but it seems as if it has evolved without much consideration.
It's from a sustaining perspective,
a sustainable,
I would agree. Yeah.
I mean, people are very concerned about zoning, right? What you can do. But in terms of, I guess the thing that I have is I've seen that in different cities across the country, one of the things, the zoning rules that require parking,
yes,
with a building are clearly modern embodiments of the idea that the car is everything.
Car is number one.
Car is number one.
Right.
And so if you can't build a building without a certain number of parking places, then that limits what you can build.
Sure.
Right? And say downtown Franklin, you couldn't, if you can't provide enough parking places, then you just can't build it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Whereas a different conception that says we have different modes of transportation, we all don't need to have a car.
Right.
That the car is not necessarily king. I don't know, that's anathema, right? I mean, people don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
But that, you have to get into that mindset. When you look at a zoning code that requires parking with that mindset, you say, well, no, this is not right. This is not a good idea.
Right. Yeah.
Because you can house more people. If you don't have, there was some statistic about parking cars as having the huge footprint in Manhattan.
Absolutely.
I mean, how many parking places there are for cars?
Even in Franklin.
Really?
You can, there are statistics and we can pull them out where the parking for a business, and even on our walk on Saturday, we were almost noontime downtown opposite the Black Box. So Ferrara's, Central Pizza, the parking lot there, fairly large. It was probably not one third full. Mm. And yet people complain there's no parking downtown. Right. Noontime on Saturday, one third full. You could go parking very easily. And there's a municipal lot. And then there's the Ferraris and Santa Fe Grill, right? So you can go, you know, store specific or municipal. There was parking available.
But I would guess, I don't know, I would guess that that parking lot is at least the comparable to the square footage of the buildings themselves.
It's in some cases probably larger than
probably
the buildings
larger,
themselves.
Right, the buildings
at least
are
the
smaller
flat
than the
space.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so,
yes,
in terms of utilization of space, how much you're giving away by having these and again, this is not peculiar to our town. I mean, this
not
is
unique to Franklin by any means.
The country.
Nope.
And when you start thinking of it that way, you realize how many more buildings, how many more houses you could have, how many more good things you could have if you weren't always trying to stack cars up.
Mm-hmm.
remember, this was back in the 1990s. I was in Japan, and there's a big sort of industrial kind of place that built very unique equipment, and they were building a parking mechanism. This is to be in Japan, but it was the test thing was a 9x9 matrix, a 3x3 matrix, 9 cars, and they had like a little robot that was putting the cars
into
the different slots and then taking it back out. And I walked by and looked, every car had a big dent in the driver's side door. So there was some malfunction of the way the thing was, they were testing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the reason I even bring that up is the great efforts that humankind has gone to put cars out of the way,
mm-hmm.
right? And how wasteful it is,
right?
And how much better off you would be if we had could find some way to have mass transit or get people around without cars. I'll stop there.
Yeah, no, and that it leads in from a sustainability standpoint. Certainly, the state is trying to foster that with the MBTA communities of which we are part of. And that's driving some of the Franklin for All and some of the Metropolitan Area Planning Council work.
Tell me more. I mean, just restate what that is. What's the motivation? Or let me say it. It seems to me the motivation is to say that if you have a train in your passing through your community, then one way to generate affordable housing is to have housing near the train stop. That is literally more affordable, and that there's multiple goods to that because you mm-hmm. have then more housing supply and you have less traffic on the road because people can use the train to go in and out.
Right.
And then you're back to zoning. People get their back up about being told where they have to build houses in their community, mm-hmm. blah, 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 right? But the idea is a good one to try and foster dense communities near mass transit.
If the assumption is that a lot of people commute to Boston, and at one point in time, a lot of people did commute to Boston and or call it the 128 belt and then eventually the 495 belt. Things, because of pricing, clearly changed along the way. So, okay, maybe the 49, the initial assumption in terms of commuting to Boston is not the best in the world, but let's start that as a point. So at least they've got the hub and the matrix of MBTA subway, busing, rail transit. And those communities along, if they've got stations there, then they're supposed to be in fostering denser housing to make that transit walkable, et cetera, so that the people can at least live, walk easily, get on the mass transit, go into Boston, whether to work or to go shop, entertain, whatever, right?
Well, I would just say it is built into our subconscious that this is the commuter rail, right? So what's a commuter? A commuter is someone who get 8 o'clock in the morning, they get on the train and go to work, and then
right.
at 5 o'clock they go back out to their nice little...
Mm-hmm.
as opposed to a mass transit network where you can get on within seconds and be where you want to be soon.
A lot of the subways within Boston, which run every 5-10 minutes, they'll vary during the day, but that's kind of the on-demand traffic,
right.
which we don't have out here because we just have the commuter rail, and you can get 6 or 8 trains during that peak hour, and then you wait every 2 hours practically to get another train in the off hours.
What I'm saying is that if you every time you say commuter rail, it sticks in your head. Wait a minute, it's commuter rail.
Commuter.
That's a misnomer, right?
It
should be something different.
Right.
And over time, it'll slowly evolve to the point where you say, yeah, there has to be the upgrades. And, of course, changing the MBTA is no easy task.
We've touched on that a little bit. I'm sure we'll come back to that because they were building another garage. They weren't even enabling it for electronic vehicles. There's a whole other area there.
But transit is, we've come a long way from Joe Biden's tariffs, but I mean, transit is an important issue.
Transit
in
is
climate,
a piece.
And especially here in Massachusetts, because let's go back to climate change for a little bit and carbon dioxide. When you think about carbon dioxide being generated by industry belching smokestacks
mm-hmm.
or agricultural, thousands of, combined feeding operation with thousands of pigs and
chewing cows.
Yeah, exactly. Massachusetts doesn't have so much of that. The nature of Massachusetts is that the carbon emissions come from our buildings and they come from our transportation.
Right.
And they come from generating electricity.
Right. Right?
And we've been focused a lot on generating electricity, trying to get rid of coal plants so that the electricity generation is clean. But big chunks for Massachusetts in particular are the built environment and transportation. And that's why wild talk about how to how to change the transportation system is useful if you want to try and make sense of what's happening in the climate realm, right?
Yeah. And again, even just focusing just on the climate piece, okay, maybe an EV is better, but then the EV still has tires, still rides on the road, and there are still additional health aspects that EV and climate has not yet addressed. We'll have to refine our discussions at some point to include those and maybe then come back ultimately to more of a mass transit system, electronic rail, light rail, whatever, which, you know, theoretically should be even better, but how are we going to get there?
We're all going to be on a segue.
Yeah, but, I'm looking for that beam me up, Scotty type thing.
Well, yeah, so just the beam me up. So for those of you who may or may not remember the 1960s, beam me up, Scotty was the transporter where you disembodied and ended up on the space, reinvigorated yourself. But I've heard it said that 3D printing is essentially the same as the Star Trek
right.
transporter.
Sure.
Because you have a file on here. You can send that file up to the spaceship mm-hmm. with a 3D printer. They can make a widget. They can't make Captain Kirk quite yet, right? So we're working on that.
The life force is the other wrinkle there. They can replicate the body, but the life force within it is the problem.
But we could teleport a piece up to a space station and have it built on the space station. Which I find fascinating.
Yes.
Who would have thought? I mean, when I first saw the transporter, I did not think of 3D printing, but there you go.
Yeah. You know, we have made progress. such as it is. Do we want to tackle more today, or we have kind of like talked through what we needed
I
to
think,
round
I
and
think
about?
We've been over the river and through the woods on the transportation front, so we should probably leave it there, I think.
Sounds good enough. And dear listeners, if you have some additional topics, certainly send them our way. Our contact information is in the show notes. And again, thank you, Ted, for helping me navigate this road, this transit road, this making sense of climate road journey that we're on.
Great to be here, Steve.
Indeed. Well, thank you. And a quick reminder for the listeners, we do this because Franklin matters. We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements, and I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.